Welcome to this week's episode of Talkin' Loud and Drawin' a Crowd. I'm your host, Dr. Elizabeth Sierra of the University of Alaska in Anchorage, the Matsu campus in Palmer, Alaska. And joining me today is Xanthi Nieder. Dr. Nieder was born and raised in the Pacific Northwest. She is a single parent of two children, a 22-year-old son and a 14-year-old daughter. She's currently a clinical assistant professor at Washington State University in Pullman, Washington. A first-generation college student, Xanthi holds an Associate of Arts degree from Skagit Valley Community College, a dual bachelor's degree in criminal justice and sociology, a Master of Arts degree in higher education administration, and a PhD in higher education administration with a secondary concentration in cultural studies and social thought in education from Washington State University. Xan, as she prefers to be called, teaches higher education, research methods, and educational foundations and history courses for the Department of Educational Leadership, Sports Studies, and Educational and Counseling Psychology in the College of Education at Washington State University. Her current research interests include ethics and social science research, college teaching and learning, and connections between campus environment and student experience. She works to interrogate the master narratives and taken-for-granted assumptions about marginalized groups. Professional accomplishments include publication of book chapters and excerpts, journal articles, and university and national recognition. Welcome, Xan.
Thank you for having me, Elizabeth. This is very exciting and new to me. So I'm excited to talk to people about first-generation college students, a little bit about my experience and how we can help students see college as a viable option for their future development and career goals, as well as help families help their own students to persist through higher education.
Yeah, so let's just start right off at the very beginning. Can you tell our listeners, what is a first-generation college student?
Well, a first-generation college student is a student whose family members, their parents, grandparents, and prior generations have not achieved a bachelor's degree. And so, for example, my own experience is I was the first member of my family to achieve a bachelor's degree, while at the same time my mom was completing hers. So oddly enough, we can both claim first-generation college student status. But because I was first, I can still claim it.
So what difference does it make if your parents have not completed a bachelor's degree? And I'm coming from the same background as well. I was the first in my family to go to college and complete a degree. So I think our listeners would definitely be interested in hearing, you know, why does this matter?
Well, for many people who come from families who have gone to college, have achieved a bachelor's degree, they already have some familiarity with the life of a college campus, making application to university, choosing the best fit for them as far as what type of university they might want to attend, selecting degree options, all of those things. For many first-generation college students, their parents haven't navigated a higher education institution such as, you know, a Washington State University or something of the like. And so they're not familiar with how to apply, you know, costs involved, how maybe scholarships and other financial aid options, how to make connections, how to get involved with the life of a campus. And so first-generation college students kind of come in oftentimes perhaps at a disadvantage. Certainly in my generation, many of the campus services that exist now were not so strong in the 80s and the 90s. And so since then, college campuses have done much to reach out to their first-generation college students. They'll have recruitment events where university faculty members and administrators and staff members will go to high schools around the state, for example, and work with helping those students apply to college, maybe select colleges, investigate, and the colleges that they might be interested in, talk to them about different career choices that they might be interested in, and how they, and the requirements, the educational requirements for achieving those for finding those careers, I guess, or for being ready to meet the needs of those careers and the requirements. So first-generation college students, Pierre Bourdieu, who is a sociologist, he talks about social capital. And so first-generation college students may not have access to the social capital in order to figure out all of the little details that that would help them in selecting the best university for them.
So what is social capital? What kinds of things are included in this term?
Well, social capital is something, it's a complex idea, but what Bourdieu talks about is how social capital is leveraged. And so people of a higher socioeconomic status, people who are better educated, make more money, own property, things of that nature, all of the things that go into how we think about capital, those people belong to a certain social class. And they have access to things like theater, literature, and access to people who speak a certain language. Language is both a barrier and kind of a ticket into certain spaces. And with each profession, we have our own language. In education, we speak a certain way. There's a language that we use, and that allows other educators to know that you too are an educator. If you're a doctor, you speak a certain language, and other doctors will say, yes, you speak that language, you're welcome in this group. So social capital kind of is that invisible shield, I guess, so to speak, that introduces us to people who have bear similarities to us, but also so it can work for and against us.
So what difference does it make being raised around these types of enrichment activities and opportunities, like going to the theater, learning a foreign language, travel, that type of thing, versus getting those things as a first-generation student when you go to college later in life?
Well, when a person is raised around those enrichment activities, they already have a certain kind of cachet or currency, as it will be, to navigate those spaces, to interact with those groups, to enter those spaces and feel confident and comfortable that they will be able to address whatever may transpire in those spaces. When first-generation college students come to college, they may be learning about some of those enrichment activities. They may be gaining some of those enrichment activities to add to their toolbox, so to speak, that will help them to learn how to navigate those spaces. One of the things that I've noticed about myself in terms of being a first-generation college student, and some of the research also bears this out, is oftentimes when I have gone into a space for the first time, I feel a little bit awkward and I feel kind of out of place. I feel as if maybe I don't belong there. And it's not necessarily anything that anybody says or does to me. It's just me learning how to be myself in that space. And it's similar to if we think about how we behave as individuals in different groups. So we behave differently with our friends than we do with our parents, than we probably do with our grandparents, and so on and so forth. And also how we would behave with our teachers. So, and it's just extending that. So, it's extending that sphere of places where we're comfortable to places just outside of that in new spaces. So, in the professional work field, in cultural and in cultural events and enrichment, areas of enrichment that we might interact with. So it's kind of expanding our world from a family unit to the community, the local community, to maybe the city, the state, the nation, so on and so forth. And so learning how to operate in these different spaces is helpful for us. Of course, the just having the cultural capital doesn't mean that all of a sudden, you know, if you go to college, all of a sudden I have all of this cultural capital. Now I can go out and I can do whatever I want to and run the world, for example. But it does mean that perhaps you're able to communicate with a wider group of people than you were before. And so, but of course, you know, as a first-generation college student, none of that for me has been comfortable the first go-round. So it's always kind of, it's taking that little bit of a risk to put myself into a new situation and try something new, try on a different hat, and approach that in a new way. And then I'm able to feel maybe a little bit more confident the next time I put myself into the same situation or something similar.
Yeah, so it sounds like it's a matter of experience with those situations, and that students who are not first generation, they've had years of experience, let's say going to, cocktail parties or to museum openings, things like that.
Right.
And whereas working class students may not have that.
Right. And, you know, I think of all the different types of families that we have in our country. You know, for example, I live in Pullman, Washington. My daughter has had the benefit, fortunately, of going to a pretty small school system. So she's gone to school with professors' kids, with doctors' kids, with lawyers' kids. She goes, she's in the same class as some kids who, you know, their parents are the head football coach or the head basketball coach of Washington State University. She goes to school with the county prosecutor's daughter. And so so she has interactions with those students, whereas if a student lives in a low socioeconomic community, they may not have the opportunity to meet people who have those experiences. They may be going to school with students that come from families just like them, and there's nothing wrong with that. It just doesn't allow them the opportunity to learn how to communicate across economic and cultural divides that sometimes help us to feel as if we don't belong. And so it's helpful to have those interactions, and I think that's one of the things that college can bring for many students, because you go, you know, as a first-generation college student, I went to college. First, I went to a community college and got my associate's degree, and then I transferred into a four-year university. Fortunately for me, it was Washington State University, the land-grant university of the state of Washington, which their mission is to work with non-traditional college students. And I didn't really realize that at the time that I chose Washington State University. For me, it was about economics. I could afford to be a single parent and live near the university versus going to the University of Washington in Seattle, which was, you know, the cost of living in Seattle was very expensive. I couldn't do that as a single parent. So coming to Washington State University was an economic choice for me. But it ended up being the best choice because Washington State University specializes in working with students who have been marginalized or otherwise have had little or limited access to higher education. And so they provided different opportunities for me and students like me to become involved in the life of the university and to have opportunities to engage in some of these enrichment activities, as we might call them, whether it's through athletics, extramural sports, through the multicultural student centers, through the theater, amongst many other things. There's countless services now, especially, you know, almost 20 years since I've been out of my undergraduate degree, that my university offers, and I'm sure, and I know universities across the United States are offering more and more types of activities for students to become involved in, because we recognize that when students are involved in the life of a university, they are more likely to succeed and persist to graduation. So it's important that that students have those opportunities, and that they have the opportunity to get involved in activities that they meet faculty and meet administrators and meet other staff, and that they have kind of that connection to, for lack of a better term, I'm going to say adult, even though we're working with adult students, sometimes being far away from family can be very disorienting. And so to have that kind of touchstone of having another adult on campus who recognizes that kind of tension and that nebulous place, I guess, that might place a first-generation college student in, to not have their family or their support around them, that they now can find support at the institution. So to feel that support through the employees of the university can be very beneficial and can make a difference between a student graduating or not graduating.
All right. And I think that leads us right into the first song from our playlist. As usual, on Talking Loud and Drawing a Crowd, my guests curate the playlists. So I think that we're going to start off with one of your choices. It's an old favorite of mine as well, AC/DC, Highway to Hell.
Yay.
Welcome back to Talking Loud and Drawing a Crowd. Today we're talking to Dr. Zan Nieder in Washington State, joining us here in lovely Palmer, Alaska by phone. We're talking about first-generation college students, some of the issues surrounding this phenomenon. Who are first-generation college students? Why should we care? What are we doing in order to address the issues that they face in our colleges and our schools? And both Zan and I were first-generation students when we started college, and we're certainly the first in our families to get doctorates. So I would like to go in this direction, too. You brought up the issue of being far from home and feeling that you need some sort of a connection to the campus. And I know that your work is with primarily Middle Eastern students, but a lot of the same issues that Middle Eastern students face when attending higher ed in the U.S., it mirrors a lot of the experiences that Alaska Native students face when they come from the small villages out in the bush to, let's say, Fairbanks or Anchorage. And Anchorage is actually the UA campus where most of them tend to gravitate. And the things that we tend to hear is that it's more frightening to be in a city as large as Anchorage as compared to the villages. They can't find the foods that they enjoy. The cultural experiences that they're used to are not available. And the teaching is a very, very, it's done very differently in mainstream U.S. higher ed. Can you talk about some of the issues that are similar with Middle Eastern students?
Well, I can, and I think, you know, but I think, let me try to, I guess, begin at the global level and then ratchet it down to local communities. I think globally, first of all, we're seeing, and we have for some time, we're seeing many students coming from other countries to study in the United States. And that, I can only imagine, would be a very disorienting experience. You're very, very far away from home, and that support group is at a great distance. And then, of course, you know, there's the time difference, so it makes it difficult for phone calls and such. Many of our international students find solace in similar groups on campus. So different campuses have different resources available. At Washington State University, we have, you know, a whole department, for international students, but we also have international student support groups. And so that's, well, I wouldn't call them support groups, but international student services. And so there are student groups that are governed and run by students, as well as ones that the institution, supports with space, as well as with, you know, student fees and whatnot. And so those students can find people who have similar experiences, who are coming from either the same country, similar countries, or other countries that might be going through and experiencing language barriers, for example. And so that's helpful. At the national level, there has been for a long time, and there continues to be a lot of emphasis placed on working with our marginalized groups, students who have been historically barred from higher education, who have faced historic barriers, I guess. So, you know, thinking about African-American, Latino, Latino-American, Native American, Native Alaskan, Native Hawaiian, and other Asian-American groups. So there are different groups on different campuses, depending on the population, that specialize in helping these specific groups. So there might be recruitment efforts. There's also a lot of, in the last 5 to 10 years, a lot of attention has been paid not just to recruitment, but what do we do when we get these populations of students to college campuses? How do we retain them? And so Washington State University, it's the context that I know, so I'll keep talking about that. But at Washington State University, as the land-grant institution for the state of Washington, has been focused on, for example, our Native American student population from the state of Washington. And so we have a strong and vibrant Native American student organization. We have many other resources. We have the Native American liaison at Washington State University who works with both local tribes to, you know, tribes that are close to Whitman County, so the Nez Perce, the Spokane tribes, but also tribes around the state. In Multicultural Student Services, there's a Native American Student Services office and space where Native American students can arrange to meet. The student group can meet. They can come in and study. They have access to computers and access to other cultural artifacts that they may find comforting. And I know for many of our, not necessarily just ours, but for many Native American students, it's important to have the extended family close or nearby. And so the institution has been working with trying to figure out a way to bring some of the extended family over for, you know, for the duration that the student might be in school or for longer periods of time. And so I think whenever a student is looking for, you know, thinking that they want to go to a university, it's important for them to find a university perhaps that's close to them or a university that will help them to maintain some of the support that they get from home. So,
Zan, earlier you were talking about feeling like yourself in various contexts and how that can be very difficult if you've not grown up in, you know, doing those types of experiences, events, stuff like that. And I'd like to relate a little experience from my own life and see what you have to say about this type of thing from your point of view. When I was in graduate school at Syracuse University, for the students, they had this wine and cheese event with the faculty. And as a working class student from a pretty low socioeconomic status background, I saw the invitation for this and I almost didn't go. The first thought that went through my head was, how bourgeois. I am not going to this thing. I'm not going to go and munch on cheese and drink wine with professors. I thought it sounded terrible. And then there were the insecurities related to that. First of all, I love cheese, but I don't know anything. Well, at the time, I didn't know anything about various types of cheese, the different types of little forks and things like that. And I sure didn't know much of anything about wine, because when I drank beer. So it was a very uncomfortable situation, but I didn't understand, I think, that there was a purpose to this event aside from just eating cheese and drinking wine with somebody. Could we talk about this type of experience for working class students?
Absolutely. W.E.B. Du Bois had a really great phrase that has widely been used, and it's called a double consciousness. And he talks about how African Americans have to have this double consciousness, because they have to have the skills and abilities and language to navigate their African American communities. But because we live in a predominantly European American world, and even though, I'll put this kind of in parentheses, even though the tides are shifting and we now live in a much more multicultural United States. We still, the dominant group is still largely European American, not just in appearance, but also in the rules that govern the spoken and unspoken rules that govern our social structures within the United States. And so he said, African Americans need to possess the skills, traits, abilities, language to navigate their African American communities, but they also need to have the skills, traits, and abilities to be able to and the language to navigate the European American world. And I would say that this is true for every marginalized group. We have to, and so thinking about myself, I'm biracial. I'm half black and I'm half white. And so thinking about that, we have to learn how to speak the language of the dominant group, to speak the language of our professions, of our workplace, of the mainstream, I guess, and we have to be able to speak the language of our communities. So I, too, come from a low socioeconomic background, working class, blue collar. I come from a very rough and tumble neck of the woods, you know, and so going back home for me, it's kind of this idea of code switching. So I kind of got to go, I have to go back into that world I don't know that I speak any differently in that world than I do in my professional world, perhaps in intellectual ways, because I am a professor, but I've learned to just be me, but it's taken me some time and taking the opportunity to go to those kinds of functions like you were describing that makes me feel a little uncomfortable, perhaps insecure within myself and the way that I communicate and the way that I carry myself, the way that I dress, perhaps the way that I look, those types of things, so that I learn and I have those opportunities to learn and to practice my skills of communication and presentation of myself. So I've learned through many years of professional employment and as well as my educational experiences, I've learned to kind of merge the two into who I am today, but it's taken a lot of time, a lot of reflection, kind of internal reflection. What am I willing, what pieces of myself, of my historic self, my low socioeconomic upbringing, my working class upbringing, my biracialness, my womanness, my single parentness, all of these pieces that make me who I am, how have I managed to navigate those and merge those into my professional identity? What pieces do I present at what times to what people? And sometimes those pieces of myself come up in professional situations, and sometimes they don't. For example, I've learned, particularly, and maybe I'm for me, I'm a little bit of a what I might call a late developer. It took me until my master's degree, and probably more the beginning of my PhD, for me to start thinking about. I don't want to, like, at first, I guess in my undergraduate, I just wanted to pretend like I was also from a middle class background, that I had these social skills and abilities. So I tried to ignore all of the different pieces of myself that were marginalized. And then somewhere in my master's degree, in the beginning of my PhD degree, I said, no, these are the things that give me strength. These are the things that make me strong, that help me to persevere, that make me who I am. And so I've learned to make those not deficits, those pieces of myself, biracial, single-parent woman, middle-class, or lower socioeconomic status background, blue-collar background, all of those pieces are my strengths. They make me who I am. So now I feel like I am better at, one, being able to identify students who have some of those traits and abilities and maybe feeling a little bit unconscious of themselves, or not unconscious, I'm sorry, a little self-conscious of themselves. So I'm better able to perhaps identify them and identify with them. And some of those traits of myself make me a little bit more accessible to my students. And so I think in this idea of code switching, we have to know sometimes when we can leverage those pieces of ourselves, when we can say this is a strength, and sometimes when even, I guess, never to think about those pieces as a deficit, but when to say, this is a strength for me to call upon right now in this situation with this person. I need to call from my past to bring it to bear on my present. And those are things that through education, through self-reflection, we're able to better navigate. It's kind of like a roadmap, right? You can always choose which path you want to go down. And we always have to, I guess, when we come from the backgrounds that we come from, we have to choose, well, we don't have to choose, but there's choices for us to make as to which path we want to go down and how we want to walk that path. Do we want to walk that path trying to be something that we're not? Do we want to walk that path being who we are, or do we want to walk that path being who we are and who we want to become? So it's kind of trying to merge all of those things into which path we choose and how we choose to take that path. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, it actually calls to mind an article that I read when I was an undergraduate that has stuck with me all this time, and now I use it in some of my classes when I'm teaching. And it's called Making It by Faking It. And it was a study of working class students who were first generation, who had graduated from college and were now attending elite Ivy League law schools. And it wasn't about their academic performance as much as it was about how they felt that they fit in and the socialization, the growing pains, because, again, I think a lot of people might assume that, you know, once a first-generation working-class student gets their bachelor's degree, you know, they're set. So if you want to go to, let's say, Harvard Law, you should be able to fit in just fine. But this study found the exact opposite, that these students felt like highly uncomfortable, for one thing, in most of these situations, because many of their peers at the upper-tier law school had also gone to upper-tier colleges and not community colleges, not state colleges, things like that, and so brought with them different experiences, viewpoints, and things like that. And a lot of these students didn't feel that they fit in, and they felt like they were wearing masks, that they were faking it a lot of the time just so they could get by.
Right, right. And, you know, I think and I haven't read that, so I'm going to have to read that. And I think that that's true. There was something many years ago when I was in one of my former lives, that was kind of a motto that many of us adopted, was fake it till you make it. And I think that there's value in that. Looking to people who you admire and emulating them. And I think that that's important, and I certainly wouldn't be where I'm at today if I had not done some of that in my own personal life and professional life, is looking to the people that I admired as scholars, as professionals, as whomever, and learning to kind of model some of their behaviors and some of the way that they approach their work. And so I think that there's huge value in that. I think the other thing that brings to mind, though, to me, is several years ago, 5-7 years ago, there was a movie on Lifetime that got a lot of, it was highly publicized, of course, on Lifetime, but it also got a lot of media attention. It was based on the true life story of a young woman, and the title of the movie, I think, was Homeless to Harvard, and she was, came from an alcoholic, low socioeconomic status, on public assistance, family life, abuse, and all sorts of things happening in her childhood, and she ended up being homeless, and she completed high school on her own, and then she got accepted to Harvard and all of this. So it was an empowering and an empowering story, and the young woman who the story was about was interviewed probably on Oprah and in different news media. And I think that there's value in that, but I also caution that while those stories are really exciting to watch and empowering to watch, that they sometimes ignore the real, one, they ignore the lived experiences of people in similar situations, and two, they tend to raise these kinds of stories up and say, well, look, if she could do it being homeless, and she could finish high school, and she could go to Harvard, why can't all of these other people? So I always say there's caution, you know, that we should be excited about these stories, but we also need to be cautious in making these stories kind of part of the grand story, you know, the master narrative is, well, if she can do it, anybody can do it, because it's not necessarily true. Different opportunities and people converge at different times in our lives to help give us, help us bring things together. And I remember, for example, in my own story, as when I was at the community college, I was a single parent and I was on public assistance. My son at the time was around 2 years old, and I was returning to college after having stopped out for a little bit. I was returning to college to finish my associate's degree. And because I was on public assistance and I needed help with daycare, I had to, one, do some testing with the agency that was helping me, and two, I had to have all of my professors each week sign a slip saying that I had been in class, which was absolutely humiliating, because it just announced that, hi, I'm on public assistance, I am super poor, and so anyways, but this test that I had to take through this agency tested me on all of these, you know, academic skills and abilities, and one of them, I've always tested low in math. I have a math learning disability, and that score sunk all of my other scores. So while all of my other scores were at the college level, my math scores were slightly above the elementary school level. And so I had to meet with this counselor once a week or once every 2 weeks or something like that through this agency, and she said, gosh, you know, they say for every hour in the classroom that you should spend 2 hours studying, and I see by your scores here that you may not have the aptitude for college, and actually you probably want to double your study time, so instead of for every hour in the classroom 2 hours studying, you should probably study for 4 hours. And so she was kind of copying an attitude with me. In hindsight, I can look back and say she was kind of copying an attitude with me and trying to tell me not to go to college, trying to dissuade me from that. Fortunately, I knew what my scores were, and I knew, you know, and I was performing well in all of my other classes. So I felt confident in saying, that's not true. I study just as much as anybody else, and probably less in some of my classes. Math is hard for me. And she looked at it a little bit more closely and said, oh, yes, I do see that it's math. The rest of your scores are just fine. You're at the right level. And so she was certainly not a person that was coming, you know, that was going to advocate for me until I pointed that out to her. So throughout my education from the community college on, I've had people who came into my life through various ways and means who helped me, one, navigate the higher education space that I was unfamiliar with. Two, they were supportive of me, so that they either mentored me or supported me in other ways through advocating for me. So when I think of the people who help people through situations, I think that there are the supporters, such as, you know, your support group, your family, your friends, the people who say, good job, I'm so proud of you. There are the people who mentor you, who show you how to do things, who introduce you to certain things, and help you to navigate new and different spaces. And then there are also the people who advocate for you, who will go to bat for you when perhaps maybe you're being treated unfairly, or you may not know how to advocate for yourself in this new space. And then there's the people who will sponsor you, who will invite you into certain spaces. For me, it was one of my mentors in graduate school, Dr. Foster. I never thought that going to a professional conference like I wanted to go, but I never knew one how to go, and I didn't know how to make myself comfortable in those spaces. And so my very first professional academic conference, he told me, he said, you should put in a proposal and you should go. And so I did. And when I went to the conference, he was there and invited me into the space, and he was very welcoming and very excited and exuberant to see me. And that was my first entry into that space, and it made me feel so, it boosted my confidence, and it made me feel much more welcome in that space. And so mentors, advocates, and sponsors are the people that I would say first generation college students and their families need to search out and find in order to help their students navigate those spaces, because those people will be critical in helping the person move to a new space, move into new spaces and new situations. The other thing that I wanted to add was back to your story about the wine and cheese event, is whenever those events happen on a college campus, I know, like at Washington State University, when I was a student there as an undergraduate, the hospitality students would host like an etiquette dinner. And that's a prime example, like a prime opportunity for students who don't have those backgrounds to say, I can go to this etiquette dinner. I can learn which fork to use at these fancy schmancy meals. I can learn about the different courses and how to carry myself in those spaces. And so every function, even though it feels uncomfortable because it's a new experience, but I look at it as every function on a college campus is part of your education, whether it's a formal class or a group or an event or whatever, it's an education for you to learn how to be in those different spaces, and that just helps to alleviate some of the stress. I mean, I think about going to a fancy dinner and where there's, you know, all of these forks and different knives and different glasses, a water glass, a glass for drinks, and a cup for coffee or tea, and all of these different plates. Going to some of these events will help to alleviate the little details so that you're not stressing and worrying about which fork to use when or which glass to use when. Do I go right or do I go left? Kind of thing. So I think I look at it all as being part of the educational experience, and there's a lot of different opportunities to engage in those on different college campuses. So seek them out, find them, use them to help you feel more comfortable in some of those new spaces that you may eventually participate in.
And that brings us to our next song on the playlist that you've curated. Let's have some Metallica. This is a classic of theirs, Master of Puppets, here on Talkin' Loud and Drawin' a Crowd with Dr. Zan Nieder. Welcome back to Talkin' Loud and Drawin' a Crowd. I'm your host, Dr. Elizabeth Sierra of the University of Alaska at Anchorage, the campus in Palmer in the lovely Matsu Valley of Alaska. And today we've been talking with Dr. Zan Nieder about first-generation college students and some of the cultural differences and other issues that they face in their day-to-day lives, both in college and beyond. And both of us speaking as women from that very background, low socioeconomic status, first-generation student, woman of color, that type of thing. There are so many of these intersectionalities that come into play in the lives of students like ourselves. So I wanted to come back to something that you mentioned earlier about learning, and we were just speaking of this too with the etiquette dinners and the wine and cheese events and things like that, these experiences that help you to learn how to navigate those environments that you're going to face later on in your professional and personal life as you go forward. One of the things that we see working with students as they get socialized into these types of environments and try to find their own voice, their own self within those spaces, is that when they go back to their homes, they go back to their communities, there's often this very odd double bind that they're put into. Their families, their friends, and their peers may be supportive of the idea that they're pursuing higher education and quote-unquote bettering themselves, but at the same time there's pushback because of the behavioral changes that they perceive, and they may feel that they're being left behind as the student goes forward. Let's talk about that.
Oh, yes, that's a difficult one, and sadly to say I'm not well-versed in a lot of the literature on that. I do know that historically, different groups have sometimes felt ostracized, perhaps, from their primary group when they come back from college. But I think we've moved into an era in higher education to where many of the different units on a college campus now work with students to help them perhaps make that transition a little bit smoother and are more supportive. Let me go back for a second. It used to be that there was one way of thinking about higher education or education by and large, that it was a Western European way of doing things. And in order to approach higher education, you had to forget who you were and approach higher education from that way. So it was an assimilationist kind of perspective. Now we're coming into an era, we're in an era where we understand that there are multiple different identities that people have, and that's okay, and also to where it's much more egalitarian. We want our students to be able to contribute to their local communities. So, you know, at the neighborhood level, at the city level, or at the county level. And I think when we listen to, you know, one of the things, and not to bring politics into it, but one of the things that President Obama has said over and over with each new school year since he's been president is, you know, we want an educated citizenry, because to have an educated citizenry, it allows people to contribute to moving their communities, their counties, their states, and the nation forward. And it helps us all to be able to contribute to a stronger economy. And by economy, I don't necessarily mean just the monetary piece of that. But I believe in that. I believe that when more people are educated, we're all in a better position to help each other out. And so different populations of people in the United States, some people, I mean, the United States is oftentimes critiqued for being an individualistic country, and in many ways that's kind of one of the undergirding premises of this country. But there are many communities within this country as well that look behind them or look at the people who they've left behind and say, what can I do to help you move forward? And sometimes that's by being a role model. And sometimes that's by going back into their communities and giving back, whether that be as now, for Native Americans, if coming into higher education, if some of the Native Americans get, say, a teaching degree and they become a teacher, then they can go back into their communities and they can be a teacher and think about the power that has for the Native American children on their reservation attending that school. Then they can see, wow, I can be a teacher, and they can bring in some of their own culture, or for African Americans, or for Latino Americans. So seeing somebody who is like you, who has achieved something, going back into their communities, being able to contribute as a teaching professional, as a medical professional, whatever it is, as a counseling professional, and I don't mean counseling as in people need help. I mean being there to contribute to the community, to help the community strengthen itself and move forward. So I think that there's huge, huge value in that. And I think that for the students who go back to their local communities and maybe feel a little bit ostracized, find ways of participating in community life that are, one, sustainable, and, two, tied to the local economy and the local to the local circumstances, whether that be community gardens, whether that be, whatever the local things within that community are that help the people of that community. I think that that's the most, I think that's where a lot of the power of higher education lies, is being able to contribute to the local spaces that we occupy.
And I think that's a really positive note for us to end on today. Thank you, Dr. Nieder, for joining us here on Talking Loud and Drawing a Crowd.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Likewise. We're going to go out on the last song on the playlist that you've chosen for us. And it's a favorite of mine, too, from the early 90s, the grunge era, Alice in Chains, Man in the Box. And join us next week for another great interview with a guest-curated playlist on Talking Loud and Drawing a Crowd. I talked to some of the movers and shakers in the arts, education, literature, human services, and what have you from the Mat-Su Valley and beyond. I'll bring them right here to you in Alaska on Radio Free Palmer. I'm Dr. Elizabeth Sierra. I'll see you next week.